Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. So today we are taking a deep dive into what I think is a really landmark work, Jean-Marie Gustave Lucrezio's 1980 novel, Desert, or Dizzer. And you really can't discuss this book without mentioning Lucrezio himself, can you? A Nobel laureate, obviously, but someone always positioned as this explorer of a humanity beyond and below the reigning civilization.
Absolutely. And Desert is often seen as, well, perhaps the key expression of that perspective. He'd written quite a bit before. But this was a real breakthrough, moving towards something more accessible, maybe, but still incredibly poetic.
Right.
And yes, it engages with post-colonial themes, definitely. But it goes, I think, much deeper than just political critique. It's really a profound look at memory, spiritual freedom, how myth sustains us.
I find the structure itself fascinating. These two stories woven together across almost 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the constant presence binding them is the Sahara. It's not just scenery, is it? It feels like a living entity, a kind of sanctuary.
Exactly. It acts as this resonant chamber between past and present. It's an epic of endurance, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it throws this fundamental question at you, the listener, right away. How do you keep your soul, your heritage, intact when the world around you seems bent on erasing it?
Let's dig into that historical strand first. The story of Noor, set around 1909, 1910, it plunges us straight into this this desperate final stand against the French colonial forces, the Nazarani.
Mm-hmm.
Noor is just a boy, one of the blue men, the Tuareg tribes, seeing the very end of his people's way of life.
And he's positioned crucially as a witness, you know, not really a warrior himself. He's observing what Lucrezio portrays as this absolutely heartbreaking dissolution.
All their hopes are pinned on Sheikh Ma al-Amin.
Right. This incredible spiritual figure trying to unite these desert tribes. It's presented as more than just a fight for land. It's framed as a holy struggle. It's defiant faith against, well, impossible military force.
The narrative of Noor's journey feels so relentless. It's just this grim march, starvation, thirst. They're fighting the desert itself as much as the soldiers.
Yeah, the elements are as much an enemy as the technology.
And the final confrontation, when it comes, it's brutal. Old rifles, faith,
yeah,
against machine guns. There's no contest.
And that moment of the rainstorm. It's almost cruel, isn't it? This brief, miraculous hope.
Only to be immediately followed by just devastation.
And it's an education in pure loss for Noor. He survives physically, but his world just evaporates. The people scatter, become, you know, ghosts in the new order.
But he carries something forward.
Yes. In the novel's logic, he becomes the living memory. The story seems erased, but it persists, buried deep, waiting.
Which brings us, 70 years later, to Lala, Noor's spiritual heir, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
Her world is the legacy of that loss. She's growing up in this shanty town, edge of a Moroccan city. Materially, it's nothing.
Utterly impoverished in that sense, but she has this intuition, this fierce connection to the elements, the light, the wind, the sea, she feels them.
She's got this resilience, and this figure, the Hartani, the mute shepherd, he's vital, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely central. Her silent protector, her spiritual guide almost. He embodies this existence completely outside society's rules, pure, uncorrupted.
And the novel strongly suggests he's the father of her child. That feels incredibly significant.
It is. It means that lineage, the desert spirit that Noor carried, it bypasses the compromises of the town. It continues through Lala, through this pure connection.
So the heritage is safe in a way, but the modern world intrudes this pressure of an arranged marriage.
Right. That's the catalyst. It represents everything that would stifle her spirit, her independence, and it pushes her to make this huge leap, the journey to Marseille.
And France is just a shock to the system for her.
A violent sensory shock is how it's described. All that intense light and color of home is gone, replaced by perpetual gray gloom, indifference. She's traded material poverty for a kind of spiritual poverty.
She's adrift in the city, trying to survive, working menial jobs.
And this is where Lucrezio's critique of Western values really sharpens. Her beauty, this untamed quality she has, gets noticed by a fashion photographer.
Ah, the transformation.
Exactly. She's plucked out, rebranded as Gypsy. Suddenly, she has this incredible material success. Fame, billboards, money.
The dream, in one sense, but the novel portrays it as, well, another kind of colonization.
More insidious kind, definitely. It's depicted as a theft of self. Her face is everywhere, this exotic icon. But Gypsy isn't her. It's a mask, he writes, that had stolen her name and her soul, leaving her empty inside.
She's trapped again. Economic freedom, but spiritual enslavement. valued only for her surface.
Completely divorced from the desert wisdom she carries within her.
Okay, so she has everything the modern world prizes, fame, wealth, but she's empty. What snaps her out of it? What's the turning point?
It's the realization she's pregnant. That's the anchor, the internal truth.
The connection back.
Yes, the undeniable link back to the Hartani, back to the desert's integrity. It makes the whole fashion world, her fame, feel utterly unbearable, soulless. The pregnancy is like a spiritual counterweight.
And that leads to her rebellion. Which isn't just leaving the job, is
it? No, it's profound. She walks away from everything. The money, the career, the entire apparatus of fame. And crucially, she doesn't just return to the shantytown edge. She goes deep into the desert, the absolute interior.
Doesn't leave the circle.
Exactly. And that final image, giving birth alone, under the stars, guided only by the elements, it's this incredibly powerful act. It ensures the song of her people, that spiritual heritage Noor seemed to lose, will actually survive.
She recovers it.
She does. As the novel suggests, the real journey wasn't geographic, it was perceptual. From one way of seeing to another, she rewrites her own map.
That's a powerful arc, from external success to this deep, internal, spiritual grounding. Okay, let's try and unpack some of the big themes woven through these two stories. The most prominent has to be the spiritual significance of place.
Without doubt. The desert is paramount for L'Eclisio. It's not emptiness. It's described as a place of absolute presence, a purifier.
Yeah.
It strips away illusions, noise, until maybe you can hear something essential, the voice of God, perhaps.
And the city is its opposite.
Completely. Glittering, busy, commercial, yes, but ultimately portrayed as spiritually barren. Bankrupt.
Which ties into the theme of freedom and enslavement. Nora loses the fight for political freedom, for land. Lala gains economic freedom, but becomes enslaved by her image.
Right. The novel seems to argue that real freedom isn't external. It's not granted by states or bought with cash. It's internal. Lala finds it, paradoxically, when she's completely alone in the desert, possessing nothing the modern world values.
It turns our usual ideas of value upside down.
It really does. And connected to that is the theme of feminine power in life. Lala embodies this. Her choice to give birth alone in the desert, it's presented as revolutionary. It's life, continuity, creation, pushing back against what the novel sees as a sterile, death-focused colonial and commercial culture.
Her body itself becomes the site of resilience.
Exactly. Ensuring the culture survives even after the warriors are gone.
And the way L'Eclisio makes us feel this, his prose style is just extraordinary. People describe it as lyrical, rhythmic, intensely sensory.
You really do feel the desert heat, the grit.
Yeah.
And that style is key to the theme's landing. The dual narrative structure, too. Cutting between Noor's epic past and Lala's modern struggle, it creates this incredible resonance. It makes Lala's personal crisis feel mythic, timeless.
It elevates her story beyond just, you know, a contemporary social issue.
Precisely. We see her carrying the weight of that history, that survival. It forces you, the reader, constantly to compare our idea of civilization with maybe something more fundamental, some deeper truth.
It's a challenge, isn't it?
It's a profound challenge. The novel's lasting power, I think, is how it forces us to question our own values, to look at the glittering cities, the allure of fame and wealth, and then consider the silent, enduring light of the desert sky. Where do we locate true value? What are we willing to trade our own authenticity for?
It's an incredible testament to how a culture's spirit, its wisdom, can endure even after facing total material destruction. It survives in memory, in blood.
And suggests that inner kingdom, the realm of heritage and spirit, ultimately that's unconquerable.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.